This is the state of things from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. The holiday season is a time, of course, for gratitude, reflection, and resolution. And resolution can't occur without confronting the uglier parts of our past and present. For years, Sandra Westerveld and Kimberly Cook have been studying the criminal justice system and looking at the lives of exonerees after their release. Their book is called Life After Death Row, Exonerees' Search for Community and Identity. And it explores the lives of 18 exonerees released from death row. Sandra Westerveld's an associate professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Kimberly Cook is a professor of sociology and criminology at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Sandra and Kim, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sandra, give me an idea of the scope of wrongful conviction in the United States. What we know is wrongful conviction.
Well, the first thing to know is that it's actually hard to know how many wrongful convictions there are in the United States because there's no systematic way of keeping track of them. When we first started our research, there was really only one list that existed at that time in the early 2000s, and that was the list of death row exonerees. So those were the people who had been convicted of a capital crime, sentenced to death row, and then had later been exonerated because of substantial evidence of their factual innocence. When we started, there were 110 death row exonerees, and now there are 141.
That's a little surprising. What I thought you were going to say is it's hard to know because we don't know how many people are still behind bars in heaven. But you're saying, no, we're not even keeping a list of those we know.
We don't even, well, only recently have we started to try to keep track in a systematic way. So for a long time, there were a variety of lists. There was the death row list, and then once the Innocence Project at Cardozo Law School, Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, once they got started, they started keeping a list of DNA exonerees, and there are a little over 300 of those now in the United States. So we had that list. We had another list that a professor at the University of Michigan Law School put together, but there was no mechanism for keeping track of people who had been wrongly convicted of crimes, much less those that are still languishing in prison. Now, in the past, just over the summer in July of this past year, this professor of law at the University of Michigan School of Law, along with Rob Warden, his name is Sam Gross, and along with Rob Warden, who is the head of the Northwestern Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University, put together something called the National Registry of Exonerations. And they put that online, and they encourage individuals or attorneys to send in their cases. And it's the first time that we've actually had some kind of set mechanism for keeping track of exonerations. And they are now up over, I think, about 1,100 exonerations in the United States going back, I think, only to the 1980s. Wow. So
Kim, what is the focus of your study?
We set out to explore the harrowing experiences of people who had been accused of a capital crime, wrongly convicted, and then later sentenced to death, and then ultimately exonerated and released from prison. There is we anticipated that there would be a lot of difficulties getting in touch with some of these people. So we worked through our community of colleagues, other scholars, and attorneys to contact the exonerees to try and have an opportunity to interview them. We read as much as we could about their stories in as much detail, either from legal documents or from media coverage. And then we were able to do 18 in-depth life history interviews with these people, and they shared with us some of the most terrifying moments any human can experience.
Were those moments mostly in the trial process, in the process of being convicted and sentenced, or in the aftermath even of their exoneration?
All throughout the experience of, for instance, Gary Gauger, who was accused of brutally murdering his parents, and they were in their 70s, and they were bludgeoned to death in the most horrifying way, and he found their bodies, and then he called the police, and then he was later accused and tried and convicted and then later exonerated. When the truth was revealed, that's someone else had actually done the crime. So he's mourning the loss of his parents, to whom he was very close. and at the same time fighting a legal battle that he didn't understand. And so for him, the terrifying experiences ranged throughout the entire process of the original accusation. And then later on, when he got out, of course, some people continued to believe that he was guilty and got out on a technicality and continued to treat him badly, which left him feeling it was safer for him just to remain at home. And so he became inclined toward remaining at home and being isolated, which is difficult.
And that story points out another interesting and kind of horrifying fact. In that case, he's accused of killing a family member, Sandra.
Correct.
You talked about it being him in the mourning process, but in a way, the trial process interfered with that, as you point out in your book.
That's true. We talk about some of the struggles, many of the struggles that they have when they get out, and one set of struggles they have to figure out how to manage are all the losses that they've had as a result of this process. And for some of them, those losses included the death of loved ones. Four of them were accused of killing those loved ones, so they were not allowed to obviously grieve those losses while they were being tried and convicted for those murders. But others of them lost loved ones while they were incarcerated, and they're not allowed the opportunity to visit with family. Sometimes they don't even know that it's happened for weeks and weeks after the fact. They certainly can't go to the funerals. And so we talk about in the book how they struggle with something called frozen grief, where when they get out, all these feelings that they've had kind of displaced for a long time finally are allowed to come back, because now they can finally visit the grave site. I think of one of our exonerees, Scott Taylor, who was accused of an arson in which his wife and his young child died, but also five other people in the apartment complex. And the first thing he did when he got out after 14 years was go to the graveside of his wife and his infant son to grieve their passing.
And of course, when we think about grief, one of the things that helps us through is our friends and other loved ones,
right,
many of whom you've lost in the process of this trial, haven't you?
Correct.
Kirk Bloodsworth is a good example of that. When he was accused of killing Don Hamilton, his mother and father stood behind him as passionately and as ardently as possible and devoted every penny that they had to provide him with support and legal representation while he was incarcerated. It's interesting to note that Kirk is the first death row exoneree who is exonerated on the basis of DNA evidence in 1993. While he was in prison, his mother passed away from cancer, and he's convinced, and he shares the story with us in the book, that his mother's cancer was due in large part to the stress that she endured with him being in prison for murdering a 9-year-old girl, which is a horrible thing to be accused of.
And if I could add, some of them don't have that. So some of them did have ardent supporters who sacrificed a lot of their financial well-being to see them exonerated, but some of them didn't have that, and their friends assumed they were guilty and left them, and or their family members assumed they were guilty. Kim talked about Gary Gogger, and he has a sister and a brother, and the sister stood behind him, but the brother did not, and still to this day believes that he is guilty of that crime, and they have no communication. So the support that they get is very important to their ability to cope when they get out.
Well, I wonder to what extent the severity of the accusation has to do with their reaction and reentry. The fact that you've been accused of this terrible crime is something I guess you just can't walk away from. You can never separate yourself from that? Or is it more difficult? Is it the fact of the severity of the crime a factor in how easily or how well they reenter?
Well, certainly we studied the most severe cases, right? They're capital cases, so every one of them had to have been accused at least of homicide. Many of them were accused of homicide and an array of other very heinous kinds of offenses, arson, robbery. Several of our cases were the rape and murder of little 9-year-old girls. Those are the people that we have focused on. Other exonerees, however, still have those same struggles when they get out as well, because we in our country, we stigmatize offenders of all shapes and sizes, not just capital offenders. And so they struggle with stigma when they get out, mm-hmm. and the vast majority of them do not get their records expunged. That's not an automatic part of the process of an exoneration. So most of them still have a criminal record that's visible on their record. So if an employer wants to check up on them when they apply for a job, there's their capital conviction on their record, even after they've been exonerated. So that continues the stigmatization process. And a lot of times the officials in the case don't want to admit that they're innocent, and they will maintain their guilt even though the person is exonerated. They'll, in public and in the media, say, yes, but I think they still did it and they're still guilty. So stigma is a big problem when they get out.
Stigma and the system. So that's not just in our imaginations. We'll talk more about how the system makes it hard to re-enter, and also the myth of restitution when our conversation continues. Sondra Westerveld, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. Kimberly Cook, a Professor of Sociology and Criminology at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Their book is Life After Death Row, and our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the Upstage Cabaret in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio, talking today with Sondra Westerveld and Kimberly Cook. Their book is called Life After Death Row, Exonerees' Search for Community and Identity, and explores the lives of 18 exonerees released from death row. And Sondra, before the break, you were talking about the fact that, and this is, I think, comes to a surprise as a lot of people, you're exonerated, you're found not to have committed this crime, and yet the crime remains on your record. Is that an oversight, or is there no way to get it off, or doesn't it come off automatically, I guess?
It doesn't come off automatically. There's no process in place in most states to have that be linked to the exoneration process. So typically that's up to the exoneree, him or herself, to pay an attorney to negotiate that process. And, of course, exonerees are in the worst position to negotiate that because they have no funds. So when they get out, they typically have no money. They need medical care and they need transitional services to get reintegrated into the community. So they don't have extra, they can't pay for their food, much less pay an attorney to get their record expunged.
You're probably not in the position to answer this, but why not? Why wouldn't that be automatic?
Well, I think that the awareness around wrongful convictions is fairly recent in our criminal justice system, and the more people are aware of it, the more that society and state legislatures and legal processes can come to bear to correct that oversight. I think it's an unfortunate oversight that creates a lot of obstacles for exonerees. We know that when exonerees get out of prison, there are a myriad of practical needs that they have, including where to live. They get kicked to the curb. They are not eligible for post-release services that even parolees get, and what parolees get is inadequate to effectively assist parolees. So exonerees get nothing. They get less than what parolees get. So they have to find a place to live. They have to get a state-issued ID to be able to even do anything, you know, to open a bank account, to even have any money to put in a bank account. They have to find a job to support themselves because they're also not getting automatic compensation, so they have no money to find a place to live. They need to have an opportunity to buy new clothes, even if they don't have funds to buy new clothes. And the process of, after living in a cinder block world for up to a decade or more, coming out into society and getting used to all of the new sensations of society, whether it's the fast pace or the colors or the smells or the sounds.
Or the technology.
And the technology. You know, we've had exonerees who went into prison when 8-track cassette players were popular, and they come out and it's cell phones that flip open and nobody really knows how to use those things unless you've been part of that social change incrementally.
They need medical care. They need dental care.
Go ahead.
They need mental health counseling. And these are things that they don't get.
And as you say, there's nothing in place. Even the paltry reentry programs there for people who have either are on parole or they finish their term are no longer available because you're kind of a
you're an exoneree, you're not exoneree. A parolee.
So right, which is why we think that programs such as Witness to Innocence are very important for exonerees for a number of reasons. They can assist with the practical needs of an exoneree to reintegrate back into society, but they also can assist with just understanding what it's like to go through this because it's exoneree-led. Witness to Innocence is led by exonerees and in order to assist other exonerees so they get some mentoring along the way when they get out, if they're linked into that group.
Also, you know, I think kind of going back to your original question, which was why do we not provide them with these things or why do we not expunge their record? And I do think there is some resistance on the part of the state to kind of own the issue and own their role in that issue. State officials sometimes have been very forthcoming. We have a wonderful case in North Carolina of Ronald Cotton that actually was a transformative case in our state that really opened the eyes to a lot of state legislators and the public about how this can happen and what role the state can play in assisting exonerees when they get out. And in that case, really, the state officials stepped up to the plate and did the right thing.
Well, but tell us about that case.
Well, Ronald Cotton was a case in it's not one of our cases because he was not a capital case. He was convicted of rape, retried and convicted of two rapes. It happened in Burlington, and many of you probably have heard of this case because Ronald and the woman who was the eyewitness in his case, Jennifer Thompson, wrote a book together recently called Picking Cotton. But Ronald's case, Jennifer was one of his rape victims, and she picked him out of a lineup because the actual perpetrator was not present in the lineup, and he looked the most like her actual perpetrator. And he went to prison for 11 years for that rape that he did not commit. When he got out, at the time, North Carolina's statutes provided only $5,000 of compensation for somebody who was wrongly incarcerated, and it, I suspect, had not been used in a very, very long time. But that case, because the police officers in that case and the district attorney in that case were very forthcoming about how this was a wrongful conviction, this person did not do this, and Jennifer was also very supportive of getting Ronald some assistance. The state stepped up to the plate, and they changed the compensation statutes at that point to $20,000 per year. We've now changed it again to $50,000 per year. They changed it to $20,000 per year, and Ronald was able to get that and get some additional transitional services and assistance. So sometimes state officials really step up to the plate, but sometimes they don't.
And you can't always count on restitution or compensation. Right. In fact, it happens rarely.
Right. Very rarely.
Well, tell us about that. So you're not automatically eligible for restitution in these cases
no.
in various states?
Well, it varies by state. So there are only 27 states in the District of Columbia that have compensation statutes at all. So part of whether or not you get compensation is surely by luck of location. In those states where they do have compensation statutes, they vary tremendously from as little as $5,000 a year to Texas, which provides $80,000 a year and additional services. North Carolina's statute, most recent statute, was enacted in 2008, and we provide $50,000 a year. However, what happens by statute is not necessarily what happens on the ground. So, for example, in North Carolina, we say we provide $50,000 a year for somebody who's wrongly convicted. But since 2008, only about 23 to 25% of those exonerees have actually received that.
Well, Kim, what's the delay? What's the hang-up? Why have they not all received it?
Well, that's a really good question, and we don't really have an answer to that question because we haven't been able to systematically examine the specific cases in North Carolina in much depth at the moment in terms of trying to explore what kind of compensation did they try to pursue and what kind of compensation did they get and what kind of compensation were they denied and for what reasons. Those would be great additional research for someone to conduct.
In North Carolina, we're one of only four states that requires an exoneree to also get a gubernatorial pardon. in order to get compensation. So we put an additional step in between their exoneration and their receipt of compensation. So that means the exoneree has to, again, find an attorney who's willing to apply for, go through that long process of applying for a pardon. And then it's up to the governor whether or not they want to give a pardon or not. And we've had several cases lately in North Carolina where they've applied for a pardon but have not received that pardon. And it's totally up to the governor, and the governor does not have to give a reason as to why that pardon is denied.
Well, and I would guess, and I don't know how you research this, but I'll ask the question that, again, the severity of the charge. I mean, if you were ever accused of raping a child and murdering that child, then the governor, even though a court process said you weren't the one who did it, how can the governor stand up and say, I'm gonna say, you know, you're free? I mean, is there that charge, that political problem because of the severity of the crime?
I think it does make it political. Whether it's linked to the severity of the crime, we can't say because we haven't studied that. But it does make it a political issue. And we would argue that if somebody has been exonerated, then we're not sure we understand why there needs to be an additional political decision made about the validity of that exoneration.
Go ahead, Kim.
There's also the factor when some of these cases are highly publicized cases, high-profile cases. And that factor alone can really affect the political process and the outcomes of the political process, particularly when you have high-profile spokespeople out there saying, you know, doing what they want to do to advance their particular agenda regarding the case. It also is very complicated by whatever public comments the victim survivors might be saying at about the same time. So in the cases where we've studied, the exonerees that we've had contact with who have had contact with the survivors of the original, the victim survivors of the original crime, and those victim survivors have either offered an apology to the exoneree or have extended a hand of compassion to the exoneree, that makes a world of difference in terms of how the exoneree is able to then move forward with his own or her own sense of self intact or restored. But it sometimes makes it difficult when a victim survivor who is also a victim of this wrongful conviction in a different kind of way has continues to make comments about believing in the original conviction in the first place. And that complicates the entire political process in ways that are very difficult to untangle and difficult to get through.
It sounds like this is a place where elements of the restorative justice process, and I don't know how much of that entered into your research, could go a long way toward making reentry easier because it wasn't such a divisive process to begin with. It wasn't an adversarial process to start.
Well, I'm not a native of North Carolina, but I'm going to use one of my favorite expressions from my adopted home state, bless your heart for knowing about restorative justice.
Here that doesn't always mean bless your heart, I want you to know. But I'll take it. I'll
I've
take
come
it in the spirit.
To learn. I mean it in the good way.
All right.
We have had that conversation. Restorative justice is an avenue of trying to approach a situation with a goal of helping the people affected to attain some level of healing. So if crime is about injury, then justice should be about healing or helping to promote healing rather than continue to promote additional harms. And that's one of the basic cornerstones of restorative justice. And what we argue in Chapter 12 of our book is that using restorative justice principles to help address a remedy for exonerees when they're returning to society could include, whenever it's possible, an opportunity for the victim survivors of the original crime, if they're willing to, obviously nobody can be forced into these conversations, to have an opportunity to talk to the exoneree about what the experiences have been like for both of them on that. And then perhaps that could be a seed, they could plant a seed toward approaching a growth of healing within both of their souls because they're both injured parties in this process.
Can that process work at the end of what was an adversarial process where people did have to take sides and have to be polarized?
Well, it can, but it's very difficult to accomplish, and it depends upon the willingness of the individuals who have an opportunity to participate with good faith with each other.
Sandra, talk about the exoneration process itself. I'm guessing that varies from state to state. How difficult is that?
Well, exonerations happen in a number of ways, and there are some kind of traditional patterns, and then there's an additional pattern in North Carolina that makes us unique. Exonerations, well, typically what we would count as an exoneration would be somebody who has been released because of a pardon. That happens very rarely, however. The more typical paths are somebody who has been convicted of a crime, and on appeal, their original conviction has been overturned and sent back down to be re-adjudicated. At that point, sometimes prosecutors decide that there's not enough evidence to move forward because oftentimes the case is overturned because there's a lot of bad evidence or there's evidence that was withheld by the prosecution that should have been given to the defense or people have recanted or changed their mind. And so prosecutors oftentimes are in a position where they can't move forward because the case, the evidence has changed. And they will dismiss the case. That is, they will dismiss the case, but not based on a technicality, based on substantial evidence of the person's factual innocence. So that's one avenue. Another is if it goes back down after being overturned and they decide to retry the case, and then on retrial, the evidence of their factual innocence is revealed, and they get a not guilty at retrial. Those are the traditional patterns. I will tell you, though, there's an additional one in North Carolina that makes us unique mm-hmm. because North Carolina is the only state in the United States that has something called an Innocence Inquiry Commission, where we have a process that we go through, or some cases can move through, to get an exoneration that's not available in any other state.
Because often when you appeal a case, it's based on the way the trial itself was conducted, not about any evidence that didn't make its way into the
right.
trial. So there could be all kinds of, and unless it was wrongfully withheld.
Well, there's a famous Supreme Court decision where the justices, the majority of the justices, said that even somebody who's not guilty could be convicted of a capital crime through due process.
Right.
So it was the appeals process is to review the process of the original conviction, not necessarily to retry the evidence.
Which is why that Innocence Project here is mm-hmm. is unique, because you can actually do what we all think is intuitive. If I had evidence to show someone else did it, that should be allow for a new trial.
And North Carolina has been identified as an important crucible of reform. That's a quote from a scholar at Roosevelt University who we happened to meet when Sandra and I were in Chicago recently for a conference, and she said, ever since the Ronald Cotton case, North Carolina has become a very important crucible of reform where actual innocence is concerned. And we should take a great deal of pride in the recognition that our colleagues around the country admire the way we've been doing things in North Carolina.
Does it make a difference for the reentry of the exoneree if they've been proved actually innocent and, in fact, the guilty party's been found versus someone who's been left off on a so-called technicality? Those technicalities, by the way, are a court process, and they're the difference between lynching and a court process.
Well,
so we can
yeah.
call them technicalities, but there's still an open question about who did it. Is there a difference?
Yes, there is a difference. We found that there are a number of factors that make a difference in the kind of experience that exonerees have when they get out, and one of them is if the actual perpetrator is identified as part of that process. And that matters because that becomes known to the public through the media, and as a result, the public then have somebody else to blame for that crime, and the stigma issue tends to alleviate itself because then the exoneree is not stigmatized for something that they didn't do. Another factor that also we found matters a lot are the public pronouncements that the officials in the case make in the media. And if you have officials who continue to argue for the person's guilt in spite of all this evidence that has come out, then that makes a huge difference to the community, and that can exacerbate the stigma that they experience. On the other hand, if you have public officials who offer an apology, for example, and we've had that where they really offer a meaningful apology, I'm so sorry this happened to you, we'll try to work to make sure this doesn't ever happen again. If they do that and they do that publicly, that also can make a big difference because the community understands that this person truly was wrongly convicted and should not be stigmatized for that.
It's a wonderful book. We're so happy you wrote it. Tell us where the proceeds go, Kim.
The proceeds from the sale of this book will be donated to two nonprofit organizations. One I mentioned previously called Witness to Innocence, which helps exonerees adjust to life once they get out of prison from capital crimes that they didn't commit. And the other organization is a nonprofit organization called Centurion Ministries, which is out of Princeton, New Jersey, and they provide legal representation on a pro bono basis to prisoners who have claims of innocence that are continuing to make their way through the courts.
Thank you both for being on the program. Great to talk with you.
Thank you.
Sondra Westervelt, Associate Professor of Sociology at UNC Greensboro. Kimberly Cook, a Professor of Sociology and Criminology at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Their book is called Life After Death Row: Exonerees' Search for Community and Identity. Coming up, does Nathan Bowie deserve to be on death row? We will explore the question on the state of things. Please stay tuned.